Hi, good day, and welcome to the special episode of Unapologetic. It's just after sort of 2 a.m. in London, just after 9 p.m. in New York, and I'm with Professor Roy Cressa-Granda today, and we're discussing the likelihood of Mamdani winning and how that's going to change the USA. Professor, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Before we actually start our conversation, currently as it stands, we're about 10 minutes past 9, 36% of the votes are in, and Mamdani has 51.5% of those votes, and Cuomo has 39.7%. Obviously, the polls project that he will win. We're going to start this conversation, which is probably going to take about an hour and 15 minutes, assuming that that stays in line. And if that doesn't work out, then we'll pivot the conversation. So just to sort of start with, Professor Roy, I've seen, you know, through your recent lectures and also your activity on social media, you are very pro Mamdani. What's the thoughts on that, right? But also, how significant is this? I mean, if you can answer both at that, what's your personal thoughts? But then also, how significant is this in the event that Mamdani does win?
So, I mean, it is significant in many ways, and it's not at the same time. So one of the things that makes it very significant city, and we're going to have a person who is ethnically Indian from Uganda, who's Muslim, who's a democratic socialist, who's anti-Zionist. Like, it's layers of, wow, how's this happening in New York City? At the same time, he also very much represents, I think, what the majority of New Yorkers believe in terms of economic politics, in terms of social politics. And of course, there's been a massive shift in the United States, in re-examining the United States' relationship with Israel. And so, and especially amongst the Jewish community in the United States. And so I think in some ways, he's actually just telegraphing where New York City is right now. On the flip side of it, who's he running against? He's running against, you know, Cuomo, who went down in disgrace. And it's you know, he lost the primaries to Mamdani and then decided he's going to run as an independent, which is what a nasty person does, right? You know, I can't accept defeat, so I'm going to go ahead and cheat, basically. And then Silva, like, just it's impossible to say his name without laughing a little bit at the end. And so at some level, too, he doesn't have real competition. And that's also, I think, telegraphing where New York City is today, right? The city has been maturing and growing and developing intellectually in a way that I think is interesting, and he's become a centerpiece of that.
I mean, in many ways, the election also has become a focal point. It's got global attention, it's got national attention in the USA, because it's very much a standoff between the things that Trump represents, and then there hasn't really been an answer to what Trump represents from the Democrats. They've also been very establishment. And Mamdani, as you know, was not accepted initially by, and to a large extent still is not accepted initially by, the Democratic establishment. They're obviously getting him, they're getting increasingly behind him as this election data has come about because simply of how he's polling. But I mean, he also represents a change in US politics. Do you think that's significant? Do you think that what's given rise to that? I'm guessing the answer is going to be a mixture of Trump and a bit of what's happened in Gaza and Israel. But yeah, just what do you think of that moment in terms of a bigger clash that's happening in the U.S. political spectrum?
So, you know, since Nixon was elected, the United States has been trying to figure out which direction to go in, and it's been trying to go in two directions at the same time. And one direction was to sort of maintain the old liberal regime that FDR had created, and the other direction was to flip back to a pre-FDR, you know, kind of rabid capitalism that triggered the Great Depression. And what Trump represents is something even more extreme. Instead of going back to early 20th century rabid capitalism, he wants to go back to 19th century, you know, white supremacy, actively ethnically cleansing the Native American population and slavery, right? Like, make America great again really is make America 19th century again. And what Mamdani represents is this sense of wanting to go into the future. And that means not necessarily going back to the liberal regime of FDR. That doesn't mean going back to rabid capitalism. That doesn't mean going back to the 19th century. He represents the 21st century. And in that way, he has split from the Democratic Party, which is why the Democratic Party is what was hesitant to jump on board, because he's not talking about, you know, let's make the United States 1945 again. He's talking about let's make the United States 2025. And I think that's why you saw that resistance from the Democratic Party. On the other side, he's in a blue city. The United States is so badly divided between blue and red, right? Like this, the major cities are blue. The states with the high GDP are blue. The big states tend to be blue. Texas and Florida, obviously, being exceptions to that. And he represents those the core of those blue places, which are pro-labor, they're, you know, pro-gay rights, they're pro-human rights, pro-civil liberties. They're states that want, or cities that want to innovate. And in that way, he doesn't really reflect, I think, the radical change that everybody's pretending he's reflecting. He's reflecting what the core of that population really wants. Whereas rural United States, especially, has been attracted by Trump. And so that's where the split is. That's where the difference is. So it's not surprising to me that he could win in New York City. It's surprising to me that the Democratic Party didn't figure out a way to take him out.
when you say that it's surprising that the Democratic Party didn't figure a way to take him out, unpack that for me a bit, because I mean, I see that. I mean, I went when Mamdani a year ago. I mean, it was just if you've seen his social media recently, and maybe you have. He literally was standing on New York street corners. No one knew who he was. He's trying to get people's attention. Come and talk to me. I'm running in the mayor election. People are just ignoring him. And he's really, I mean, he may still not yet definitely win the election, but it does seem like he will. And he's definitely now, you know, I mean, everyone in New York knows him. People, he's been on all the popular podcasts. Almost anyone in the USA would now recognize his face. So why do you think it was that the Democratic establishment couldn't stop him?
Yeah. So one of the things that every politician is always thinking about, like they're super obsessed with, is how do I get reelected? And so at some level, you know, it's hard for a politician to take a position against a popular position, especially if, so the Democratic Socialists, the DSA, decided early on that what they wanted to do was pull the Democratic Party to the left, that their goal was to make the Democratic Party, you know, a little bit less liberal, and a little bit more socialist. And the way they were going to do that was by operating from inside the Democratic Party instead of splitting off and creating a second party, or sorry, a third party. And the reason why that was necessary is because of the way single member district representation works in the United States. Had they made a third party, they would have just hurt the Democratic Party. They wouldn't have pulled the Democratic Party to the left necessarily. They would have just made it lose elections. What I think happened with Mamdani is he was saying things that were resonating so strongly with voters that voters were willing to overlook their sort of implicit bias, their racism, their anti-Muslim feelings, and somehow he made that leap and he crossed over that. And once that happened, the Democratic Party, I think, became nervous about challenging him because they don't want to lose elections, they don't want to lose ground. But he represents this wing of the Democratic Party on the left that most mainstream Democrats don't want to, mainstream Democratic elected politicians don't want to see succeed. Even though I think, based on how Bernie Sanders did in 2016 and 2020, that there's actually a really powerful core of people in the Democratic Party who do want to see people like Mamdani win.
Okay, so I mean, I want to kind of touch on two kind of sort of fights that he's up against, right? So the one is a whole bunch of the Democratic Party, which you've kind of spoken about. And then the other one is the Republican Party and MAGA and Elon Musk and everyone else on from right to far right to extreme far right, who for a bunch of reasons, him being a Democrat, him being Muslim, his identity, would be opposing him. So, I mean, just that's what we're going to explore. And I'm sort of going to ask a bunch of mini questions. So the first is, I mean, Trump has clearly put a target on Mamdani's back.
Yeah.
I mean, he's even said if Mamdani becomes the mayor, he'll stop federal funding to the U.S. to New York City. Cuomo's kind of like tried to ride that waves, maybe unintelligently, to kind of get some votes. Elon Musk has made it clear that, you know, Mamdani is persona non grata, call him a bunch of things over the last months on X. Just what are your thoughts? Do you think they actually empowering Mamdani through this pursuit of him?
You know, that's one of the interesting things. They endorsed him yesterday. Musk and Trump finally endorsed Cuomo. And I kind of feel like, in a way, they've made it certain that, I shouldn't say that word, certain. They've made it extremely likely Mamdani will win. Because that was, if Cuomo had a chance, the last thing he wanted to have happen was an endorsement from Trump and an endorsement from Musk. That may have been his death knell. And the reason I'm saying that, of course, is because New Yorkers have grown to profoundly dislike Trump. And New Yorkers don't like people who are extreme far right. And that's what Trump and Musk now represent for the majority of people on the left and the majority of people in the center, I think, in the United States, is that they've gone off the rails. They're pursuing some kind of crazy agenda. Musk is flipping Nazi salutes. And you know, I think having somebody who flips the Nazi salute twice back to back in New York City is anathema. Like, that's not going to fly. That's not a positive sign. So I feel like, in a really strange way, in their attempt to attack Mamdani, they made him increasingly more and more popular. New York City, most of the blue cities in the United States are looking for ways to push back against Trump. And so they really gave Mamdani an endorsement, in effect, right? It was the anti-endorsement, but it was perfect for him.
You early on you mentioned that sort of, you know, Mamdani, because of what he says resonates with the working class and resonates with the issues impacting most, you know, Americans and their economic needs. A lot of them have been able to look past their racism, their anti-Muslim bigotry, or whatever it may be. Do you think that's true of New York as well, which is a lot more cosmopolitan? I mean, or do you think in New York that the fact that he is, I don't think it's worked for him, the fact that he's a Muslim or you know, is not a white person. But do you think that's an easier threshold to break through New York and will struggle to that his electability, if he was, you know, had to run for, you know, across the country, or if other people like him had to run in other states, that would be difficult for them? Or do you think that's a hurdle? Do you think that you know, people of color or Muslims or non, you know, white candidates could start breaking through?
So the United States has a profound amount of racism and implicit bias. Like, this is just sort of built into the bones of the United States. I mean, you gotta remember, its foundation was genociding Native Americans and taking their land over. And people thought, yeah, that's totally legit. I don't see a problem with that. And then, to make it really work, forcibly bringing over Africans and then stealing their labor through slavery. And again, people were like, yeah, I don't see a problem with that. You know, so from its very foundation, the United States had this really powerful anti-Black and anti-Brown bias. It's so deeply ingrained now that the Brown and Black population in the United States has this anti-Brown and anti-Black bias. And it comes through, if you've seen the studies on implicit bias, you can see that, like, literally it's affected everybody. I'll give you an anecdotal thing. I know a New Yorker who is from South Asia, and he's an immigrant, and he's Muslim. And when he speaks about immigrants, it's just pure anti-immigrant disdain. Like he sounds like a white Republican from the South. It's hard to even, you're like, dude, do you understand what you're saying? You sound like you hate yourself. And at some level, that's exactly what's happened. This aspiring to whiteness, white supremacy, white privilege has seeped into even the bloodstream of really the brown population more than the black population. Having said that, New York is cosmopolitan. Many people have taken the steps to kind of overcome some of that implicit bias and racism. If there was a city he had a really good chance of winning, obviously I think New York is one of those places. There's plenty of other places in the United States. If it's a big city, he has a chance because the big cities are cosmopolitan. And people, one of the things that we know is when people are around immigrants, their implicit bias against immigrants goes down. And so just the fact that there is such a huge history of immigrants coming into New York City does make it so that it's not as outrageous. Having said that, Louisiana elected a South Asian governor at one point. He was a Republican and a conservative. And so, it's not that it's impossible for a brown person to win an election in the United States by any means. One of the phenomena, though, that I'm always worried about is backlash. So if a white person gets elected and something goes wrong, everybody's like, yeah, of course, things go wrong. If a brown or black person gets elected and something goes wrong, they go, oh, it's because that person is black or brown or Muslim or Jewish or whatever whatever not Protestant white male they are. Or she's a woman. And so what we tend to do is forgive white male Protestant errors and just assume that there was nothing you do to stop it. But then we attach causality to the gender or race or religion when that person doesn't fit that profile. And that's, of course, one of the hard things I think brown and black and for that matter, women politicians have to face in the United States.
No, I mean, many people would be able to argue that, Trump was able to rise at the back of Barack Obama, because even though Barack Obama was quite a successful U.S. president by many, many accounts, there was a sentiment among the right, which, started seeing they're losing the country, the country's being lost to white faces. I want you to pick up on that. Before that, as it stands now, 52% of votes are in, and 49.6% is what Mamdani has, and Cuomo has 41.5%. There's also been more than 2 million votes cast, which I think is why Middle East Eye is having a live stream of the New York City elections, because it shows that there's global interest on this, right? We've how much do you think? And I mean, this is it's a bit of a difficult question to answer, but how much do you think, Mamdani's success has come about because of what's happened in Gaza? And the fact that, especially in the primary, the Democratic primary for New York, all the other candidates were saying that, I'm sure everyone's seen this clip. Everyone was, they would go to Israel first. And he kind of said, I'm a New Yorker and I'll stay in New York. And he's been very, articulate and unapologetic, to use the word, in calling what's happening in Gaza a genocide. How much do you think that actually matters? Or do you think it really is his economic agenda, which is put him where he is?
Oh, I definitely think that the Gaza crisis has played an important role in his success. And one of the reasons is because, especially among younger people in the United States, there has been a shift in support for Zionism. People are beginning to realize that the Zionist project is a settler colonial project that requires genocide to succeed. And people are beginning to go, wait a minute, why are we supporting genocide in 2025? And so I think that is definitely part of his success. His campaign has hit that nerve, especially amongst younger people. But you're starting to see it even with, middle-aged people in the United States as well. There's even a shift in that direction, supporting the Palestinian cause and being less supportive of the Zionist cause. And so to a degree, that's part of his formula. One of the things we were talking about was, you know, Barack Obama's election helped cause Trump. I totally believe that, just for the record. One of the moments that I remember, that I reflect back on now frequently, is I have a friend who is half, his one parent is half black, half white. One parent is half black, half white, and the other parent is Dominican, which is, you know, essentially the same thing, half white, half black. So he is essentially half black, half white. So he's like Barack Obama. And we're walking together, and it was in Austin. I'll never forget it, like the moment, because it was just such an interesting moment to me. And I said, "So are you excited about Barack Obama?" And he goes, "No, no, I'm not. This is a disaster." And I was like, "Wait, what? How are you not excited?" And he goes, "Every time something goes wrong, his race is going to be blamed, and that's going to come flying back on black people." And then he said, "There will be a pendulum swing afterwards." And I thought, oh, man. And I was so irritated with him, because I said, "Thanks for raining on my parade," because you could see the truth of it immediately, right? There was no way that he was wrong. And I had been sort of allowing myself to be in this little bubble. And of course, that's exactly what we saw play out. The whole birther movement was a question of whether or not it was okay for a black man to be president of the United States. The guy he ran against, the guy that Obama ran against, the guy that the Republicans voted for, was John McCain. John McCain was born in Panama. Barack Obama was born in Hawaii. If the Constitution didn't allow people born outside the United States to run for office, then how did McCain run? And yet somehow it made sense in people's minds that it was fine to vote for the white guy who was born in Panama, but it was not okay to vote for the half black guy who was born in Hawaii because he wasn't born in the United States. Like, it was, how did this happen? That's a lot of cognitive dissonance. If we could figure out a way to harness cognitive dissonance and generate energy from it, we would have an infinite supply just from the United States. We don't even need the rest of the world. And so, you know, there's also the possibility, and it's not even a possibility, it's clearly the case, that one of the reasons Mamdani is also successful is that there's that pendulum swing back from Trump, because what the people are reacting against Trump being elected and the policies that he's doing. And so in a way, Mamdani's success is tied to the election of Trump, and Trump's success is tied to the election of Obama. So we're like on a sine wave, and I don't know how to get off the sine wave. And it feels like the crests and the troughs are getting more and more extreme as time goes by. And I guess at some point the sine wave will break and we'll do a violent civil war and just kill each other because we can't stand each other.
Okay, so I mean, we've spoken about the pendulum swing from Barack to Trump, and you've said that in many ways, Zoran's success is in a response to Trump. Obviously, you know, I mean, he's spoken about the specter. I mean, and Trump has said, you know, that we've seen ICE go into cities and kind of disrupt, you know, the what would be, you know, city lines and kind of disrupt jurisdictions and all these kind of things. That's played into this, but I mean, what do you see? I mean, it's difficult to tend, but I mean, as a historian, you can kind of spot trends, and this is one of the reasons why we're looking to you. What do you think the pendulum swing against Zoran would be like? And how do you think, can he protect himself against it? Or is just the macro trends of history too great? And secondly, how do you think it's going to impact? I mean, because it's kind of related, which is why I'm asking both questions. How do you think it's going to impact the Democratic Party?
Okay, so one of the patterns that I see playing out is we'll elect a guy that has good ideas. So I'm not saying every politician has good ideas, just so we're clear, because we'll frequently elect a person who has bad ideas. But we'll elect a person who has good ideas. They'll start implementing it, and then they'll start to run into issues in the implementation of those ideas. So the biggest one, of course, is institutional lethargy. the trying to reshape the city government in New York is going to force Mamdani to spend a lot of his political energy. So if he has 20 policies he wants to enact and he pursues all 20 policies, he's almost certainly going to fail just because he has a limited amount of political energy to spend. And if he tries to do everything, he'll put too little in each one. If he's successful, he's going to have to just pick a few, go after them. When that happens, when politicians do that and they succeed and they show results to the voters tend to get enthusiastic and then go, oh, I like that. And then that's what creates re-election results, positive re-election results. The problem is then when you're trying to pick the next level of successes, because, you know, hopefully you're going for the ones that are maybe easier, they're the ones that are going to get you the best results. As you start to go for the harder ones down the road, like in, let's say in your second term, well, there's a term limit in New York, so you'll only get two terms. You're going to very likely not be able to get as many as you did in the first round. And what tends to happen then is people get disappointed. And I think that's part of why we get the pendulum swing. There's a lot more to it than that. But part of it is there's sort of this institutional resistance that you will run into over time. Think about how popular the socialists in Europe have been since World War II. And then look at where they are now, and you'll see that the socialists just don't have that kind of pull anymore. And actually, the extreme far right is sort of replacing the socialist party's popularity in Europe. And part of that is they've just been around for so long, they've become normalized, they're trapped in the cycle of trying to get reelected. They're not getting the results that they used to. People are starting to see them part of the bureaucracy. They're starting to see the lethargy of the bureaucracy, the inflexibility, the lack of innovation, the stagnation that sort of kicks in over time. If you get into that cycle, then that's going to give you the pendulum swing. And so what I'm hoping happens in the case of Mamdani in his next 8 years, because I'm giving him a second term, is that he really pulls off some of these policies that he's pursuing. And then on the other end of it, New Yorkers don't have quite as hard of a pendulum swing, and they stay the blue city that they are. I don't think in the immediate future you're going to see the kind of reactionary backlash that we've seen in other places in New York City, but who knows? 8 years is a long time, especially because trying to imagine where the world is going to be in 4 years with AI. And it seems like our political cycles get shorter and shorter and shorter as time goes by. Whereas, you know, at one point our political cycles took 40 years. It feels like they take 8 now. Maybe by the time Mamdani's done with the first term, if he wins,
our
cycle will be 4 years.
Yeah, you said if he wins. NBC now has projected that he will win, and the New York Times has just called. I mean, I'm looking at their page right now, and they say Zohra Mamdani, the Democrat, wins the New York City mayoral race. 75% of the votes are in, and he's at 50.4%, and Cuomo is at 41.3%. So, based on all those projections, they've called it. So, I mean, it's not official, but I mean, for all intents and purposes, as we expected when we started this conversation, which I think is telling in itself that we expected. We were so confident to kind of begin this conversation as we did,
right.
And at no point were we actually doubting that. I mean, you've mentioned about political cycles getting shorter. I want to discuss that further, but before we go there, I mean, when Hillary Clinton ran against Trump, the person who was most likely to take her place to run against Trump was Sanders, and the same thing happened when Biden then ran against Trump and lost the first time, right? Do you think, and I think this is a question which most people looking outside or inside, people inside the USA, but even from outside, we're just seeing some of those pictures of, it seems like that's the party where Mamdani's at, and people are kind of congratulating each other for that. But just coming back to that, I mean, do you think that that wing of the Democratic Party, or, and I think to some extent there's even some affinity with people who look at America from outside, but even people within America, obviously, who are hoping for, you know, a more fun, a more exciting, a more edgy, a more connected Democratic Party. Do you think those people who hold out, you know, through people like Sanders, AOC, there's the squad with Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, and now Mamdani to a large extent, especially as, you know, in all likelihood, the mayor of New York City. Do you think that wing of the Democratic Party now has a bigger chance? And where do you see them in 4 years or in 8 years' time?
Yeah, so I think Mamdani's win will have the effect of continuing to normalize Democratic Socialist wing of the Democratic Party. AOC and Sanders have done a fantastic job up until now of doing that as well. So I think the Democratic Party made a terrible mistake in 2016 on many levels. One of them was that they went with what they thought was the safe bet, which was Hillary. They were thinking people liked Bill Clinton. They were thinking she's you know, a Christian. Sanders is Jewish. Sanders tends to say atheist things. That one of the chances that an atheist Jew is going to win, right? They were making those questions. They were asking those questions, and then they were also asking. Sanders is openly a socialist. Will Americans resist that? And then, of course, the most important thing was the Democratic Party wants nothing to do with socialism. They are a liberal party. They believe they are dominated by liberal politicians. They believe in capitalism. They think that capitalism is a fantastic thing, right? And so they went with Hillary Clinton. All the polls showed that the race between Sanders and Trump would not have been a close, like they were regularly 10 percentage points apart. Like it wasn't even close. One of the reasons was the American people as a whole are sick of the status quo. They were sick of the Hillary Clinton style politicians who are going to come in and give them more bureaucratic lethargy. They were going to make some promises. They weren't going to follow through with them because they were difficult to do. And then those politicians weren't going to want to spend their political clout on those promises. They were going to spend them trying to get reelected instead. And I think the American public voted for Trump because one of the interesting things is to see how many people who had voted for Obama, then turn around and voted for Trump. It was actually a really strangely large number of people. They were voting in part because they wanted to turn over the apple cart. They were angry at the system and they wanted to hurt the system and they wanted to get a different result. Their first pick would have been Sanders. Now, having said that, I'm actually glad Sanders didn't win the Democratic primary, because if he had been president, the Democratic and Republican parties would have done everything they could to completely undermine him for 4 years, right? It would have been just 4 years of getting nothing done. The Democratic Party would have prevented many of Sanders's policies from going through. As it was, when Biden won, Biden actually spent a lot of time working with Sanders on policies. And so the irony was, is Sanders was much more powerful outside of the White House than he probably would have been inside the White House. And one of the reasons why I don't feel like this with Mamdani is because I think being mayor is very radically different than being president. So I don't think Mamdani is facing the same kind of issues that Sanders is, or Sanders would have had he become president. As mayor of New York, Mamdani doesn't have to worry about what he should do, what AOC does, and that is throw everything into his policies and don't worry about reelection. And if you get reelected, it's because your policies succeeded, as opposed to what most politicians in the United States do, which is do nothing about your policies and throw everything into reelection. And if he follows the Democratic Socialist script, he should end up with, you know, being able to check off some boxes and walk away with some successes. And I think that's what's going to radicalize the American population. They're going to see the success in New York City and they're going to go, oh, I want that for my city. And so that could be one of the knock-on effects of his victory.
Do you think he will be successful? I mean, he's obviously, there's massive expectations. He represents a lot. He's young. More people voted in this particular election than possibly history, as far as I know, New York election itself. So, I mean, you know, there's a lot of expectations. He's promised a lot. Do you think he'll be successful? I mean, and also, yes, you mentioned that you know, it's much easier to be a mayor than to be a president and have the machinery work against you, but there will be machinery working against him, even if it's not, I mean, with not just New York, but there'll be, you know, press around the country. He's going to be under a magnifying glass. Trump is going to throw everything at him, which, again, like we're saying, has a dual effect of actually, you know, making him more beloved by certain parts of the population. But I mean, do you think he'll succeed?
So there's a couple of things that he has to face. One is he has to dig through the bureaucracy, dig through the political institutions. He's going to have to, you know, put a lot of energy into making sure that he gets his policies through that bureaucracy. And the bureaucracy is going to resist because it's old school people who are looking at this new guy coming in. He doesn't have the kind of connections that Cuomo did to the old establishment. You know what I mean? Like, because for the most part, in the last 150 or so years in the United States, politics has been very hereditary, and it becomes sort of a family affair, and that's what Cuomo represented. And so, Mamdani's coming in as an outsider. He's going to have to fight all that. Having said that, his biggest problem is going to be the people of New York City. So I'll give you one of my favorite examples of this, because I think Americans don't understand enough about politics to understand what's supposed to happen. So it was 2008, and I think it was August, and I think it was Indiana. I'm probably wrong about some of those details because, well, that was a long time ago. COVID happened since then, and a lot of my memory failed after COVID. Amy Goodman, a New Yorker, confronted Barack Obama, and she said, "You have promised us a lot. You have promised us, you know, all these really interesting hope and change things. Are you going to deliver, or are these just hollow promises?" And Obama's response was one of the best responses I think I've ever heard. He said, "Let me tell you a story." And he said, so Eleanor Roosevelt wanted Franklin, the president, to jump in, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, to jump in into the civil rights movement. And so Eleanor had been pushing her husband to try to get him to meet with some civil rights activists. After years of working on her husband, she finally scheduled a meeting with a civil rights activist. So the civil rights activist and her go into the Oval Office because she's going to go in there to support the civil rights activist. Like, she's actively advocating on his part. And so they sit down across the desk from her husband, the president, and the civil rights activist makes a pitch for why FDR should jump into civil rights. And at the end of the pitch, the civil rights activist goes, "Well, so are you going to support us?" And FDR's response is, "Are you going to make me?" And that's Obama's response to Amy Goodman. And you're like, first of all, it's rare you see Amy Goodman stumped, but I felt like she was stumped in that moment. and the answer is, if the people of New York City want Zohran Mamdani to pull this off, they're going to have to actually actively support him. Politics isn't you vote. This is the sad thing about this. Politics isn't you vote for a guy and then you go back to sleep and then in 4 years you wake up and you go vote again. Politics is you vote for a guy and then you continually advocate and work for that guy's causes. If you don't, you're not going to get the results that guy promised you. Or if you get them, they won't be as robust, or there will be fewer of them. And so in many ways, politics is wasted on the American public, because the American public is under the impression that they just have to vote once every 4 years and they can go back to sleep and they don't have to keep up with the news and they don't have to pay attention to what's going on around them. And, you know, like, if you want to live that life, go to a monarchy. In a monarchy, you don't have to pay any attention. You probably still should, but you don't have to. There's a guy making all the decisions for you. But in a republic, you can't be inactive. That's the whole idea, is that the public is politically active. And so if he's going to really succeed, he needs New Yorkers to back him every step of the way. But having said that, I have hope that that will happen to a degree, because I think over the last few years, maybe since Occupy Wall Street, there has been this shift in New York's mentality about politics. And I think New Yorkers are actually more engaged. And I think that's one of the reasons why New Yorkers are so attracted to Mamdani, is they realized he was the kind of politician that represented their kind of engagement. And you know, like, if he wins with 50% of the vote, that's really a remarkable win, in part because of all the things that were going against him. And in this moment that we're in, this incredibly weird reactionary moment, because you know that there is a segment of the New York population that agreed with Mamdani on every single issue until it got to Israel. And they went, I just can't. And he's a Muslim too, it makes it worse. And they went and they voted for Cuomo. Even they held their nose, and they probably had to put something in their mouth so that they wouldn't gag. And they went and voted for Cuomo for that one issue. Such a huge portion of the United States population are one issue voters. And you know that that was a huge segment of the New York population. And yet still he's going to get close to 50% if he doesn't clear it. And so that's a mandate for him. And I think, fingers crossed, but I think New Yorkers are going to back him, and he's going to get the kind of momentum he needs from the public.
Okay, I mean, so just I'm going to mention a few more. I mean, it's now confirmed. Almost every major news organization and poll has said that Mamdani is winning. He's celebrating, as we've seen pictures already, at his watch party. 83% of votes are in, and he's at 50.5. So he may well actually, as you mentioned, get more than 50%. You've spoken about Obama, and I want to ask you later on for some other historical precedents, more specifically with regards a mayor of a city, and if you can draw from that. So I mean, that's, you can think about that in the background of your head in the meantime. But just on Obama, so Obama started off, very much, someone from Chicago, connected with people. He was seen as a successful president, but I think many of his critics would be, he kind of became the establishment in terms of foreign policy. Didn't really do anything that was different from other U.S. policies. Specifically regarding all the drone strikes in Yemen and Pakistan, those were things he became under criticism for. He did create a wedge between him and Netanyahu, but I think that's an inevitability of every U.S. president creates a wedge with Netanyahu because of Netanyahu, but they don't actually do anything after the wedge is created to kind of change policy on Israel. Record detentions at the time, or at least, deportations at the time. As well. So, I mean, again, he was seen as an establishment person. AOC, lots of promise, and obviously she's still young and has a long career ahead of her, but there was a lot of disappointment when it took a long time for her, for example, to become really outspoken on what Israel were doing, when Israel was really behaving much worse than they are behaving now, if that's possible, sort of a year ago. Mamdani has doubled down, in fairness to him, whenever there's been an opportunity. Mostly he's doubled down. He's embraced his Muslim identity. He's been outspoken in Israel. He's kept his economic agenda and local issues at the fore. But as his political career goes, it's going to become increasingly tough to fight the elites and the billionaires, and they will try to co-opt him. And sometimes that's a good thing, by the way. It's not always bad. It usually is bad, but it's not necessarily bad that powerful people are trying to co-opt you. But do you think he'd be able to navigate that smartly? And I mean, if you were advising him, how would you advise him to navigate that?
I think the biggest thing that scares politicians in the United States is Israel. So, and not just politicians, anybody with a career that has any kind of profile. So professors, university professors, are horrified, terrorized into not saying anything about Israel. Saying something about Israel and the United States usually means, if it's negative, the end of your career. And Mamdani's already done that. So we're way past the mark. It's why AOC took so long to say anything, is because she was thinking, I've got all these other issues. There's one issue over here on the side that might be a career-ending moment for me. Do I jump in and say something and lose my career and then my ability to fight for these other issues? That was her calculation. Because you gotta remember, in politics, you have a limited amount of power. End of story. You have a limited number of ideas, a limited amount of money, a limited amount of support, a limited amount of voters, right? And every time you apply some of that power to an issue, that's power you've spent. And you've now gotten an opportunity cost, right? There were other things you could have been spending that power on. I think one of the things that people get confused about in the United States is they think that just having the office is the thing that gives you the power. The reality is you have to have a power base, and then you get into office, and then you use that power base to get pushed for your policies. And so every politician has to calculate, do I make an issue here? Do I spend any energy there? Obama got into the White House, and he did get co-opted to a very large degree. I mean, one of his nicknames was the deporter in chief. He built more wall on the US-Mexico border than Trump did. His first 4 years in office, his foreign policy just looked like everybody else's foreign policy. When he switched over to John Kerry as Secretary of State, his foreign policy shifted and became a little bit less normal. But you're right, like for the most part, he did get co-opted. And he even talks about it in his book. He even talks about how, as he's running for office, little by little, he's getting more and more co-opted by the rich. To become president of the United States, you are probably going to have to make some serious sacrifices. To become mayor of New York, I don't think you have to make anywhere near that many sacrifices. Having said that, I do think Mamdani does need to reach out to the rich and find some support with them. You can't, in a city like New York, you can't ignore the money. It's not going to work. He's going to have to make some compromises. It doesn't matter if he's a socialist or not, especially because we live in a capitalist society. And the United States is hyper-capitalist. It's probably the most capitalistic place on the planet. So, you know, a socialist just got elected mayor of the largest city in the most capitalist state on the planet, and you know, it's the hub of capitalism. It's where Wall Street is. He's gonna have to go in there, make compromises, and make some deals. Having said that, he doesn't have to sell his soul, and he's already taken so many really powerful stances that in a way he's got all that behind him. He can now just focus on policies, which is what I would do if I were him. My advice to him is, make some compromises, get some good deals, get past the lethargy of the bureaucracy, and get some policy successes. Show New Yorkers that you're there, that you can make something happen. And it doesn't have to be a giant thing. It just needs to be something that gets you a little bit of attention and profile. And think long term. I mean, not crazy long term, not 40 years out, but you know, think 8 years out. And don't worry about getting reelected. That would be my advice to him. Just jump in there and work hard. Activate New Yorkers. Talk to them. Keep them engaged. Don't let them go back to sleep, because that's what they're going to want to do.
Okay, and then just, you know, I mean, this is the you know, because I'm a slightly, I mean, I'm a much less qualified historian than you, but I am also less curious, but I am curious. So is there sort of other anecdotes or historical precedents where this is quite something similar? I mean, you mentioned, you know, a socialist becoming the mayor of the most capitalistic city ever. You know, I mean, so that in itself says it's not, they can't be a precedent, but is there other examples? I mean, not necessarily even United, just to the USA, but in other points of history, if it's the USA, that's fine. But other points where, you know, there's just similarities where you can be like, that's quite interesting and kind of in some way mirrors what's just happened.
So in the 1930s, the United States was much more left. There was a socialist mayor of Milwaukee, and you know, like even if you take the clock back a little bit, Oklahoma's state motto is "Labor shall overcome." And you're like, wait, what? Oklahoma might be the reddest state in the union, per person, and yet they have this really far left state motto. I know they've been trying to. Their members of the state legislature have been trying to change the motto. There have been times in the U.S. where we did see kind of a little bit of a political upheaval and a shift in politics. 1890s was another period where we saw that to a large degree, 1960s. So there have been these moments where we got some political crystallization, so to speak, and there was a shift. And it could be that Mamdani represents that right now. There are a lot of people who have been suggesting that we needed to go through Trump, we needed to do a couple of terms. I think when the dust settles, it'll be like three or four terms. And then what would happen is the American public would sort of go, oh, and that wasn't really, Gilead wasn't really a great idea. Maybe we shouldn't go that direction. And then there'd be this movement back in the other direction. Walter Dean Burnham, the political scientist, talks about political realignment, and that, you know, occasionally we get this moment, and that might be what we're in. If you're looking for individual success as opposed to a political realignment event, Obama is sort of the classic example of that, where this guy comes out of essentially nowhere, right? It was Hillary Clinton's turn. I can't tell you how many times I heard establishment Democratic politicians get in front of the voters and go, I get why you're enthusiastic about Obama, but it's Clinton's turn. He's cutting in line. This is wrong. This isn't how we do politics in America. And the American voters would boo, and they voted for Obama anyway. And so in a way, that's he sort of represents that. And when that happened at that moment, I thought we might be in a political realignment phase. I was clearly very wrong. And we ended up with Trump instead. So it could just be that it's sort of he's a one-off thing, or it could be that there is actually something going on. And it'll be interesting to see.
Okay, I've just got two questions before you can go off and enjoy the rest of your early morning. So the first one is, I mean, let's just go back into that political realignment thing. Do you think we are in a, I mean, you kind of touched on it, but let's just give it more thought. Do you think we are in a moment of political realignment? Do you think this is a part of a bigger wave? And if so, how is that going to, where do you see that going?
So we had a political realignment event basically in 1980. Nixon was trying to create that, but Nixon faltered and it failed. Reagan comes in and he does the Reagan Revolution. And what happened was he managed to talk a very significant portion of the population into re-identifying themselves as conservative. And one of the interesting things is when we polled those people, to this day, it hasn't changed. It's been 45 years of this. When we poll them on their political position, we'll ask them, what are you? Conservative, moderate, liberal. I'm assuming socialist is in the survey now. And they'll say liberal. And then you go, okay. I'm sorry, they'll say conservative. And then you'll go, okay, now, how do you feel about gun control? How do you feel about abortion? How do you feel about gay rights? How do you feel about the environment? And you go through all the little issues. And then when you're done, you put them on a scale, 0 to 6, 6 being conservative, 0 being liberal. And they land on a 2, 3 being the middle point. And they landed to the left of the middle point. And then people are like, but you identified as a conservative, but you're actually a moderate liberal. You're not actually a conservative. And that's part of the power of political realignment is sometimes you don't even actually need people to change their political ideology. You just need them to change their political identity. One of the things I think is hilarious is whenever Republicans are like, the Democrats are all about identity politics. All politics is identity politics. That's what the Republicans are about. They're about what heterosexual Protestant white male wealthy elite identity, right? That's the goal. And of course, it attracts all these temporarily embarrassed billionaires who are, you know, were making $20,000-$30,000 a year, and because they think, oh my God, those are my people. And of course, they're delusional at that point. What I think Trump has the ability to do is radicalize the liberal population and make them reevaluate where they are politically and push them in a different direction. And I think Bernie and AOC and now Mamdani are playing a major role in that shift. It's too early to tell if that's taking place, in part because the Democratic Party establishment has become so entrenched and lethargic. Chuck Schumer is like the classic example of what you don't want to see in a politician in this particular moment. And you know, he's the leader of the Democratic Party in the Senate, and you think, wow, you picked that guy of all people to pick. And one of the problems I think the Democratic Party now has is it doesn't have the kind of leadership it needs to have in this moment. And maybe the DSA can fill that gap. That could be what we're seeing the start of, but it's too early to tell.
Okay, so final question. I mean, I think in your first answer that we had this evening, you mentioned, you know, that Mamdani is Muslim, he's anti-Zionist, all of these things. I mean, let's not forget, this is kind of like a trope, the fact that I'm even going to bring this up, but this is the city that experienced 9/11. Zoran's father is Mahmoud Mamdani, who's a great scholar on Muslim identity and history and politics. His mom is a movie maker. Famous among her movies is Mississippi Masala, which is about an interracial couple. When you think about all of those things, again, just try to encapsulate for us. You kind of have already, but just when you take all of that into account, the fact that his father probably became one of the most foremost scholars that analyzed 9/11, and now this 34-year-old who no one knew about a year ago and was making really bad rap songs is the mayor of New York City. I mean, quirky, but bad. Just try to encapsulate for us just how strange and significant this is.
I mean, it's extremely strange. and it is significant. Okay, so the United Arab Emirates, DP World, purchased the Port of New York. And this was just a few years after 9/11. I don't remember the year. I want to say 2005, but I'm probably totally wrong. And Chuck Schumer and a group of politicians lost their mind. And they were like, there is no way we're going to allow Muslims to own the Port of New York. And obviously, a big piece of that was 9/11. Honestly, though, had 9/11 not happened, I still wouldn't be surprised if people went, no, there's no way we're going to allow Muslims to own the Port of New York. And they basically went to Congress and passed a law forcing DP World to sell the port. And they did. They had no choice. They had to sell the port. So now here we have a Muslim mayor, and you think, oh, wow, this is really a moment. Does this mean New York is past its anti-Muslim feelings, its anger over 9/11? And the answer is maybe a little bit, right? Like, it's impossible that they didn't at least overcome some of it. You saw what happened when DP World tried to buy the port of New York City. So at the end of the day, there must have been some movement in that direction. I think, though, some people, not obviously the majority, also recognize that 9/11 was carried out by a group of Muslims, but that doesn't mean that Muslims as a whole supported it. The reality is that the vast majority of the Muslim world was horrified and against what happened and disgusted, and they felt bile in their gut and wanted to vomit. And I think the majority of people in New York are smart enough to figure out that this 9/11 was a terrorist attack that had nothing to do with Muslims or Islam. It was a terrorist attack that was a politically motivated event that, you know, Christians could have easily have done something very similar, because they do on a regular basis. Every school shooting, every mall shooting, every time the United States blows up a third world country. And I think there's people are starting to realize, oh, wait a minute, you know, maybe lumping everybody together in this stereotypical biased way and blaming brown and black people for everything bad that happens is scapegoating, which is not necessarily a great way to operate. So I think there is that. I also think the United States has for a long time been struggling with how racist it wants to be. And since the 1960s, there's a portion of the United States that's been saying, a portion of the white population in the United States that's been saying, I don't want to be a racist. I want to move away from that. It's been a long, hard struggle, and we've had catastrophic setbacks along the way. You know, Reagan, in a telephone conversation to Richard Milhouse Nixon, when Reagan was governor of California and Nixon was president of the United States, called African leaders monkeys. And, you know, he almost completely refused to jump into the anti-apartheid movement because he really did want the white minority of South Africa to rule. It's not that we've done a great job of getting past our racism, but we've made enough momentum that we could see things like Obama get elected and Mamdani get elected. And you know, you look at AOC's popularity. Having said that, one of the things that I think is really also part of this equation, and I think it's one of the reasons why Trump was elected, is the demographic change that's taking place in the United States. It is moving at an incredible speed. I'm pretty sure it's the fastest this has ever happened for a large state. I'm sure small states it happens, but large states, you know, the United States has the third largest population on the planet. It's a massive state. The white population as a percentage of the country shrinks by 0.4% per year. In other words, by 4% every 10 years. So every time there's a census, the white population drops by 4%. The census in 2020 showed white people at 60%. White people are already 58%. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out where this is going. And so at some level, Mamdani also represents this shift in the demographics. At the rate we're going, in 20 years, the United States will be 50% white. It will no longer be majority white. It'll just be half white. And you know, at some point, the United States is going to have to reconcile the fact that it is no longer a white state. I think that's why Trump was elected, was the white population wanted to postpone that. They wanted to deport as many people as they could before they got to that stage. And just for the record, for those of you looking for past experiences, in the 1800s, I want to say it started in 1870, but I'm probably totally wrong about that. It couldn't have been 1870. But anyway, it was definitely after 1871. Maybe it was the Prussians who started this. The Germans decided they wanted to deport their Poles. They thought Poles were, you know, they did what the British did. The British Brexited because they hated Poles so much. The Germans decided they hated Poles and they wanted to kick them out of the country. There were 6 million Poles living in Germany, and they began a mass deportation project, and they took 30 years. And at the end, they reduced the Polish population by 30,000 people. So there were still 6 million Poles left in Germany. It was a catastrophic major failure. I just want to point out, if the Germans couldn't do it, the United States definitely can't. So if your goal is to deport all the brown and black people, you're going to definitely fail. That there might be a better way to come to terms with the changing demographics. And I think in a way, that's what Mamdani's election may be telegraphing, is that there is a population of people who are going, oh yeah, I can chill out. Skin color maybe isn't as important as the other issues at this point.
Dr. Roy Casagrande, thank you so much for your time. It's always a pleasure speaking with you and to you, hearing from you. So thank you so much, and best of luck with everything that you do.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks. Cheers. Bye-bye.